Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, as I promised last week, we're going to continue looking at this scenario in the global economy focused on China that continues to evolve here. I believe even today we're seeing another big drop in U.S. stock prices. This has been going on all week, on and off, and it's becoming clear that we are now moving into a period of even more financial asset contractions going on globally. At the same time, the U.S. stock prices falling, looks like another four to 500 points today after several multi-hundred points during the week. It looks like we have another leg down in the global oil price market. Yes, now we're below $30 a barrel at 29-something. Keep in mind, oil is a financial asset. It's not just a physical commodity. There's a lot of speculation in oil prices, and the speculators are in part driving down the price, just as the speculators in China sitting off in Hong Kong are driving down the Chinese stock market and the currency. But let's turn to China specifically, as promised, before we talk about what are some of the likelihoods of where this is going in China, and what are the likelihoods of contagion effects. How will it spill over to the rest of the global economy? We read more and more in the business press, more increasing concern by the big name business people like George Soros and others that, something's coming here. Something's coming, and it's not good. What is it? The global economy, they are finally recognizing, is slowing down dramatically. And they keep, they meaning the IMF, World Bank, they keep overestimating the global economy and the slowdown. They've been doing this for 5 years now. By the way, in my book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, I dedicate the initial chapters, 1 and 2, to critiquing the IMF and World Bank and their Pollyannish overestimating optimistic forecasts for the last 6 years. Every year they overestimate the economy and they have to adjust it downward, and they're doing it again. They still think the economy in the U.S. is going to grow by 2.6% next year and the global economy by about 3%. Nonsense. Nonsense. In fact, all indications are coming out that the fourth quarter of the U.S., particularly in December, is not that good. Some economists are predicting the U.S. economy will grow by less than 1% in the fourth quarter. That means it's going to grow even less than that here in the first half, one of these quarters in the first half of 2016. I've been predicting that we are about in the U.S. to experience another what I call relapse, economic relapse. Relapse is a one-quarter of a sharp drop to zero or about zero or even negative in GDP. That's happened four times now, four times since 2011. We've had this one-quarter sharp drop to almost zero, or sometimes it's been one-quarter negative GDP. And I think we're about to experience it again. We'll come back to the U.S. here after we talk about China and global oil a little bit more. But we want to look at that because the U.S. is not immune to these global trends, and they're beginning to have a greater effect, particularly on financial asset markets, stock markets, bond markets. That's kind of the canary in the economic coal mine here, financial markets. We'll talk about that. All right, so let's look at China. Since December 22nd, China stocks have dropped another 20%. 20% decline in just 1 month. Well, less than 1 month, 3 weeks. That's pretty precipitous if you think about it, especially since it comes on the heels of last summer's 35% drop in China's stock market. That got stabilized a little bit for a few months last fall, but now is on another leg down. By the way, that stabilization and even current efforts by Chinese policymakers, the People's Bank of China and Central Bank and others, they have pumped about $500 billion of their reserves to try to keep the stock market from collapsing too fast, and also to keep their currency from collapsing too fast. Their economy is slowing a lot more rapidly than they're reporting in China. They're still reporting the 6.9% GDP growth rate. No way. No way. All the other indicators, you know, freight and rail and electricity usage and everything, all indicate China can't be growing by more than 5%. Some say as low as 3% GDP growth rates now, right? Whatever it is, it's far slower than they're reporting officially in China. And you got to take with a grain of salt all these governments reporting on GDP. After 7 years, they can't get anything going again. They're beginning to tweak the numbers and play with the definitions and the data and so forth. Most recently, Japan slipped into its fifth recession last fall, compared to, you know, fifth recession since 2008. Five recessions. Short, shallow recessions. Fifth one. And then within a week, they said, oh, no. You know, it's not really a recession. That was a technical error on our part. Our revised data shows a 1.9% faster growth than we were initially reported within a week. In other words, revisions within a week, I don't believe it. You don't get revised data that big changes within a week. Usually revised data takes a month or 2 months to come in, and okay, I that would be more credible. But to change the numbers within a week, I don't believe it. I believe Japan is in its fifth recession. Europe, of course, claims it's growing at 1%, a little over 1%. If you look at what's happening in Germany, industrial production and so forth, that's questionable as well. You know, these are all statistics you can play with these numbers without falsifying them at all, with your assumptions, and make them come out looking better than they are. Anyway, you know, like India is doubling its GDP overnight by redefining it, etc. I've talked about that before. I'm not going to go on that track. But basically, China GDP numbers, official, are not believable anymore. So we got a real economy in China that's slowing down dramatically, faster than people are saying. We have a currency that's under great downward pressure. The Chinese currency, the yuan, is pegged to the dollar within a range between 6.2 yuan to the dollar and 6.6, I think it is. And it fluctuates within that range. Well, it is bumping up against the limit of that range because the real economy is slowing down. You know, if the economy is slowing down, that means the corporations aren't doing that well, and they're probably having losses, and that means that people are taking their money out of investing in China in those corporations that look like they may default or certainly aren't making profits, and they move their money somewhere else. Well, when you take your money out, you convert the yuan, the currency, you sell the stock or whatever it is, you convert the currency, and you go on money markets and you buy other currencies with it. Well, that increases the supply of your currency on the money market and global money markets and causes the value of your currency to fall. Well, and that puts it under great pressure. And China's decision, or its the fact that the IMF late last fall agreed that China would be a global currency, means that it must fluctuate now. The China cannot keep that peg to the dollar anymore. as its economy slows and money gets converted to other currencies, as people try to get out of that currency, it means that the currency is under great pressure. And if you look at what's happening with currency markets in Hong Kong, the Hong Kong yuan is really far more devaluing than the official yuan. So, you know, the official yuan has to devalue at some point, and everybody knows this. So long as the economy slows, everyone knows this. So the currency is under great pressure to decline, right? Another factor here is the stock market. You see, the stock market is unwinding in China. Now, as we reported, a second leg, 20% decline in less than a month. So when stock values decline, people sell the stock. They're not going to hold on to it when their value of their investment declines. They sell the stock. You know, they sell it in China in yuans. They get the yuans, and they take their money, and they move it out of the country, which means they got to sell the yuans to buy dollars or euros or whatever, and that drives the currency down. So, in short, what we got in China is this three-way effect, mutual effect that's exacerbating itself, currency decline, real economy GDP slowdown, and stock market collapse. And all three, right? If the stock market collapses, then the currency is going to decline. And even the fact that the currency is declining in value means people are going to try to dump the stocks as well. So it's like mutually affecting each other, stock and currency declines. And, of course, behind this all is GDP, real economy declining. So everything is going south in China. And you can see the consequences of this in the massive capital flight coming out of China now. As Chinese investors, having reaped huge capital gains and so forth in the last year or two, are trying to take their money and run. And Chinese policymakers are trying to stop it. They're trying to stop the currency decline by using reserves, government reserves of currencies, to go into the market, global markets, and buy yuan to drive the price of the yuan up, or keep it from falling, at least. And so far, they've done the same with the stock market. A lot of draconian measures late last summer to prevent the selling of stock and to increase the buying of stock by government enterprises and other entities and so forth, banks, etc., in China, and preventing the sale of stock. Big blocks of stock can't be sold and so forth. But even that, we see nonetheless continued pressure for the decline in the stock market. Well, China has committed well over $500 billion to prop up its stock market, keep it from falling as fast, and to prop up its currency. $500 billion of its roughly $3 trillion in currency reserves. How long will China do this is the question. How long will they try to prevent the currency, foreign exchange, and stock prices from falling by committing their reserves? Once they stop committing their reserves, of course, the whole decline will accelerate. But that's a big question, right? And we see about $1 trillion in capital flight just last year alone coming out of China. Capital leaving, both by the government using it to purchase foreign currencies, and also private capital flight leaving. A lot of this capital flight leaving is going into cash buying by rich Chinese investors, cash buying of real properties in the U.S., housing, right, apartments, even businesses, and in the western part of Canada, and in Britain, in London, and in Germany and other places, Australia, etc. This is where this capital flight is going, flowing out of China, right? It's important to understand also that speculators, global speculators sitting off there in Hong Kong and elsewhere, are also driving down the value of the currency and the stock market. So we have real causes behind the collapse of stocks and currencies, which are just financial asset markets, unwinding. The bubbles are unwinding over there. Due to speculators, due to currency, due to stock, due to the real economy, and so forth. In other words, there's no real light at the end of this tunnel. All these forces are in play. Chinese policymakers are fighting with the speculators, trying to prevent them through various market means of speculating and driving down shorting, they call it, driving down the value of the currency. But we'll see how this plays out. Right? At the same time, we have a big problem in China of massive debt. Total debt in China is about $30 trillion, I would say, total debt. At least $26 trillion of that has occurred since 2008-2009. Right? This massive debt run-up is the source of a big problem. Now, you know, you hear a lot of economists, both on the left and elsewhere, talking about, oh, we got a debt problem. But they usually talk about government debt, sovereign debt. That's not the problem in China, right? And sovereign debt is really runs up as a result of bailing out private debt, bailing out banks and the private sector, and taking that debt on the government balance sheets through various means, which I talk about in my book, by the way, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy. There's three sectors of debt that you've got to look at. One is a private debt, which is both business and financial and non-financial, household debt, which is consumers, and government debt. Government debt, of course, is not just a national, federal, but state, local, provincial, etc. Right? You have to look at the debt and how debt has risen in all these three sectors. Generally, those who write about debt just talk about its magnitude and don't understand the sectoral differences between debt and how the different sector debt exacerbates each other. That's important, how business debt exacerbates household debt and government debt and so forth, back and forth. They mutually determine each other. So it's not just the magnitude, total level of debt, but the interaction of debt and the various three sectors that I talk about in my book. That's key, right? By the way, those interested in far more detail can go to my blog, jackrasmus.com, and you can simply click on the book jacket and you can purchase it there. And if you go to my website, which you can get to from the blog, jackrasmus.com, you can get some free chapters to read, particularly the chapter on China I've just posted on my website, which is Kyklos Productions, KYKLOSProductions.com. So if you want a more detail of what I'm talking about in China, the book has just been published here January 1st, so it's very much up to date. Just go there and to the website for the free chapter, or you can read some of the articles I've been writing for Telesur, South American Media Consortium here, backed by Venezuela, Argentina, and other countries. So either way, you can find out more about this. This is an ongoing development, and we're going to be seeing a lot more interesting evolution of this situation in China and its impact on the rest of the global economy in the coming weeks and months here. This isn't going away. Anyway, if you want more detail, go there. You can buy the book at discount on my website, jackrasmus.com. Okay? All right, so let's get back to what we're looking at. The massive debt in China, massive increase in debt in China. Well, where does debt come from? It comes from liquidity. In other words, money capital being created by central banks. Ever since the collapse of the Bretton Woods system in the 1970s, central banks led by the U.S., have been pumping massive amounts of liquidity into the economy. Every time there's a recession, massive liquidity injections. Every time there's a financial crisis, even greater liquidity injections. And general secularly over as we decentralize the banking system and global money capital flows, generally as well, not just cyclically, massive amounts of continuing increase in money capital injections by central banks. Well, in 2008-09, the U.S. Central Bank began policies of zero interest rates, quantitative easing, special auctions, and so forth. And all of this has resulted in somewhere, I estimate, between $10 and $15 trillion, at least, minimum, of money injection into the economy by the U.S. Federal Reserve, the central bank. Other central banks have done the same. QE, zero interest rates, so forth. Europe, UK, Japan, all of them. All of them are doing massive money injections. The whole idea is, the logic behind it, from their perspective, is massive money injections will stimulate the financial asset markets, make the rich super rich. They'll get so rich, you know, that some of it will then trickle down into real investment in real plant and equipment, goods and services, creating jobs, wages and income. That's the whole theory behind this monetary policy-led injection and recovery. Well, as I've said many times before, it doesn't really result in real asset investment very much. A lot of it goes into financial asset investment, stocks, bonds, derivatives, foreign exchange, so forth, speculation. Mm-hmm. Some of it for a while went off offshore from the U.S. and Europe into emerging markets that were booming. China was booming between 2010 and 13, and it dragged up, pulled up emerging markets, providing it commodities and semi-finished goods of various kinds. The China expansion was driven by a 15% of the GDP stimulus in 2009, compares to about the 4% fiscal stimulus in the U.S., which was then taken back and then some in the U.S. in 2011. As we got into this austerity thing. And, of course, in Europe and Japan, it's been austerity from the very beginning. So Japan stood out with this massive fiscal stimulus, which took the form mostly of direct government investment in infrastructure and expansion of the manufacturing industrial base for the increase in export sales that also occurred. But that lasted about 3 years, three, 4 years in China, and petered out. And from about 2012-13 on, China has been trying to shift to a private sector-driven growth strategy where private investments, so the government investment and government and exports, would drive the economy, and consumption would drive the economy. Well, China hasn't been able to make that turn, and I don't think they're going to make it very easy. It's going to be very difficult for them, and they may not make it at all even, conversion, that is, from government investment and exports to a private investment and consumption. Okay, the point with China is that this policy of fiscal stimulus was accompanied by a massive increase in monetary stimulus in China by the PBOC and other government banks in China to accommodate the fiscal stimulus, okay? But it didn't end there. At the same time, China opened its doors to massive capital inflows from the U.S. Multinational corporations and others as well. And the combination of this inflow of money capital, global capital, and its creation of its own monetary stimulus ended up with liquidity expansion in China way beyond even the growth of the real economy. Here's some figures for you. M2, money supply, right? A proxy indicator of this kind of liquidity. In 2000, between 2000 and 2008 in China, M2 liquidity grew to about $25 trillion, okay, by 2008. by 2012, it had grown to $80 trillion. In other words, it grows from $25 trillion to $40 trillion between 2000 and 2008. So a $15 trillion increase between the first 8 years of this century, right, to $40 trillion. It doubles. It doubles in 4 years to $80 trillion. What took 8 years to grow $15 trillion grows $40 trillion in just 4 years. But that's not the end. That's only 2012. By 2015... we have a growth in the money supply in China to $135 trillion. I'm talking about yuan here. I'm talking in terms of their currency, yuan. If you look at it in terms of dollars, by 2009, it was equivalent to about $6.5 trillion, U.S. dollars. Okay, by 2015, it's $22 trillion. So the, money supply triples here since 2009. Their economy didn't triple. It grew very fast, but it didn't triple. So you got more liquidity pumping into the economy than ever before. Now, where does that money go? If it doesn't go into expanding real investment, in other words, plants and equipment and businesses, production, infrastructure, and so forth, if it doesn't go there, it's got to go somewhere else. Where did it go? It went into speculation and property in China. And we had this big property bubble. Local government jurisdictions, or what we call local government entities, whatever, about 10,000 of them in China, borrowed heavily to expand property and infrastructure and so forth, and became heavily indebted. And as a result, housing prices, property prices, business prices, land prices, just created a bubble in China, a major bubble in China. So that was a big problem, creating a bubble. And shadow banks in the West financed a lot of these what are called local government financial vehicles, or GFVs, that pumped up this economy locally and the property prices. Okay, it got to be a problem. Also, domestically within China, they created their own shadow banking system. There's about 6,000 shadow banks by estimates in China. And the foreign shadow banks brought money into China. And, you know, shadow banks, their main role is speculation. You know, that's what they do. They speculate on financial assets to a great extent. They don't like to invest in real assets because their returns are just not as profitable. They take longer. They're more risky. They like to play in financial assets, liquid financial markets globally, which have proliferated here in recent decades. And that speculation and that those markets and the shadow banks that are the institutions that play in these markets, behind them stand what I call the new finance capital elite. There's about 200,000 of very, very wealthy investors who move their money around between financial markets. Most of them are in the United States, about half of them, but the rest are in Europe and so forth, and growing very fast in Asia. New finance capital elite, about 200,000 of them, who have at least $5 million in net additional income flows every year, annually. That's not assets. That's money created from those assets, $5 million that they get to invest. And there's probably about, estimates are about $100 trillion in investable liquid assets in the world now that keep floating around from market to market, creating bubbles here and there, and the bubbles burst, they move the money around, so forth. These people are driving the global economy. And one of the theses in my book is that we have this relative shift of financial asset investment going on and speculation, and that is partly, maybe significantly responsible for lowering the rate of growth in real asset investing. It's been declining. Its growth rate at least, slowing down, while financial investment has been accelerating. There's a relationship between these two forms of investment, financial asset investment and real asset investment. And the real is slowing at the expense of the financial growing. This is an indicator of financialization going on. Now, why is that so? Because financial assets are just so much more profitable. They're riskier, but they're more profitable. And this is where the finance capital elite is going with all this money. That's why we see stock markets having boomed here since 2009-10. And debt markets, corporate bond markets, you know, boomed. Trillions and trillions of dollars increase in both. My estimation is global equity or stock markets increased from $32 trillion to $64 trillion in total valuation since 2008. That's $32 trillion paper valuations, but still, if you sell it, you get real money, you see. And debt markets the same. Chapter 11 of my book talks about financial asset markets at risk. And equity markets in the U.S., the valuation almost doubled, and it did double in globally. Bond markets, corporate bond markets, you know, have increased by trillions of dollars, including high-yield junk bond markets. Treasury bonds, U.S. Treasury bonds, have increased from $4.5 trillion to $12.8 trillion. In other words, the Fed selling these bonds to pay for the deficits and so forth. Corporate debt in emerging markets, meaning outside the advanced economies of the U.S., Europe, and China, and Japan, are particularly at risk. That's a result of all this money that flowed into emerging markets. You know, companies, corporations down there expanded. They borrowed the Yankee dollars often. A lot of it's in dollar debt. Expanded their commodities and semi-manufactured goods production. Their stock prices ballooned in their own stock markets. But now they're overladen with debt. The Bank of International Settlements, which is the Bank of the Central Bankers, kind of a research thing, in Geneva, estimated a couple of years ago, in 2013, that global debt had risen since 2009 by another $40 trillion. It's probably $50 trillion at least right now. The debt run-up has not stopped since the last crisis. It's increased. And much of that is in emerging market debt. And we're going to see the next crisis, I predict, emanating, coming out of emerging markets, probably precipitated by events in China. China will be able to better manage it because it has all those reserves, but economies, you know, like Argentina, Brazil, and others, South Africa, you know, Malaysia, Turkey, etc., they won't be able to manage it as well. They don't have those kind of reserves. They're already in recessions, and they have this massive debt they got to pay principal and interest on, and the money with which to pay for it is disappearing. That leads to defaults. Defaults lead to even faster financial asset collapses. When you get too much financial asset collapse, it freezes up investment that remains in the real economy, and you get contraction. In other words, the financial cycle spills over into the real cycle and causes the real economy to contract sharply. That's what happened in 2008-09, and that's what's about to happen again. The timing, of course, is very difficult to predict. But we're clearly moving closer to that precipice here. And we can see it in the unwinding of financial asset markets in China, the stock markets that are spilling over now to equity stock markets in the U.S. and elsewhere. And we can see it in the financial collapse of global oil, which is a financial asset, right? Futures trading in oil and commodities. Has dropped about three-fourths, as I said, from $120 a barrel. It's now under $30, $29 a barrel today. How far can it go? It can go further, but as it declines to $20 a barrel, you're going to see defaults beginning to appear, that's coming. It's already becoming evident, but it's going to become even more evident. At some point, all these financial asset markets unfolding, unwinding, big ones, you know, like China stocks and global oil, and so forth. At some point, it's going to change the whole fear factor here with investors, and it's going to spill over to the real economy, and that's going to start contracting even faster. And then the two feed off of each other. The real economy contraction creates greater anxiety in investment in financial assets, and they collapse even faster, and vice versa. Now we're in a downward spiral. This is 2008-09 once again. But this next crisis coming is going to be worse because the income that was available to finance the debt does not exist to the extent it did in 2007. And the Federal Reserve and other central banks have shut off all their ammunition. Interest rates are near zero. They can't raise them. They're going negative, interest rates. So what are they going to do? Right? Are they going to pump more money? That's the contradiction. You see, they pumped all this liquidity to bail out the banks, which just was used then to create even more and new financial crises. So the solution becomes the problem. You see, and it's this relationship between liquidity, money, and income to pay for the debt that's important. It's a debt-income relationship. Mainstream economists don't understand this. They keep the two variables, income and debt, more or less separate, and they don't even look at other non-income factors that determine the ability to pay the debt. Because the nature of debt is you build it up. It doesn't go away when you lose your income, when there's a recession, when there's a downturn, when prices fall, and therefore your income falls, or your sales fall, and therefore your income falls. You don't have money to service that debt. A minute ago we mentioned emerging markets, $25 trillion, mostly on the corporate side, of debt accumulated since 2009. Well, where are they going to get the income to pay for that debt, to continue to pay principal and interest when their economies are in recession and declining? And when the global economy is declining, slowing global trade, and most of these other countries require selling exports in order to generate income in order to pay their previous debt, particularly if they've taken debt out in dollars. They've got to, Argentina, for example, has to sell more goods in order to continue to pay that debt, or they'll default. I'm talking about private corporations here. Right? If the global economy is slowing down, their exports slow down, and they're not able to generate the income revenue in order to pay the debt. The same thing with households. You know, if we can't get wage growth going and we start to have more layoffs, which I think is coming here in the U.S., where's the income for the household to pay for the debt? American consumers have loaded up on auto loans, and rents are rising, and cost of education is rising, and the cost of health care under Obamacare is rising. So where's the income to pay for this huge run-up in not so much mortgage debt, but other forms of consumer debt, auto debt, education debt, student loans, right, et cetera, that has barely kept the economy and consumer going? The wage income and growth is simply not there. You destroy the unions, as we have in the United States, there's no income growth going on. All the income growth is through financial speculation at the high end. That's why you look at the IRS data, and it shows since 2009 that 97% of all the net income gains in the U.S. have gone to the 1%, 97%. Well, that's all from stock bond appreciation and capital gains. And on the other end, wages have been stagnant or falling for median families. Right? That's why you get 97% growth in income inequality trends. So the rich have been getting rich on financial speculation, financial assets, and the rest of us have to do with contingent jobs, part-times, temp jobs, or the gig economy, the sharing economy, and so forth. That's the big divide that's growing wider and wider. Okay, I talk about that, by the way, in my my book. I talk about the financial structural changes going on that underlie this, the rise of the finance capital elite and shadow banks and liquid asset markets and so forth. I talk about government fiscal and monetary policies that have fed this and exacerbated this, and I talk about changes in the labor market that are holding down wages and so forth. And when your wages are being held down, what do? You borrow more money. So households get in debt as well because wages aren't growing. But wages aren't growing because real asset investment is not growing, and that's not growing because money capital is being diverted into financial assets. So ultimately, the decline in wages and so forth and the changes in labor markets can be traced back to this changes in financial markets structure and the relative shift to financial asset investing. Okay, let's get back to China here. Bottom line, we have a tripling of liquidity in China, some of it coming from its own banking system, some of it coming from the outside, from shadow banks, pumping money in to China and creating these bubbles. First bubble, of course, as I said, was in the property markets. China tries to do something about the bubble. By the way, there are no shadow banks in China, but by 2012-13, there was thousands of them. Domestic indigenous shadow banks as well as foreign shadow banks playing the property market to try to tame the bubble in housing and property prices. China attempted to raise interest rates, you know, to try to quell all that speculation. Well, it had more of an effect on slowing China's economy. It didn't work. They did this a couple times and they had to follow up with many fiscal stimuluses to get the economy going again. China then decided to divert the money, speculative money, out of properties into the stock market. And it decided to do this in 2014, the summer of 2014. You see, China's stock market was kind of placid from 2010 to 14, and all of a sudden it accelerates. And the reason it accelerates is because Chinese policymakers say, okay, we're going to divert the capital from property markets into the stock market. And we're going to provide incentives to put the money in the stock market. China invited shadow banks and others to invest in the stock market in 2014, opened the doors, money flowed in, and also the money flowed in from domestic Chinese speculators in housing into the stock market. And the argument was, in China, by causing the stock market to boom, we would enrich private corporations in China, and they then would invest some of their great gains, capital gains from stock appreciation, perhaps into real investment. And we wouldn't have to rely on government direct investment as we had from 2010 to 13, and on exports as much as we had. So the idea was to boost real investment by boosting financial asset prices, stock prices in China. It's a supply-side argument through monetary policy. You know, the idea being if you pump money and raise financial assets, some of it will spill over into real investment. The other argument was that, individual investors in stocks, the top, 10% maybe of not even that in China, of investors and households would invest in the stock market, and they would get richer too, and then they would have more for consumption of real goods. Well, the same thing happened in China with that strategy that happened in the West. They replicated the U.S., European, Japanese strategy, the pumping of financial asset markets, arguing that it would result in a supply-side increase in real investment. Well, it didn't. It didn't. It resulted in a bubble. People just took their gains and reinvested it back into the stock market because it was rising and rising, or they invested in what's called wealth management products and entrusted loans in China. And I was investing directly in those companies, industrial companies that were now desperate for money capital expansion. And those companies are on the verge, many of them, of defaulting. So those assets, WIMPs, they call them, wealth management products, are at risk. And the stock market, of course, got a special boost, not only from China inviting foreign money into it, but by introducing new rules that really liberalize margin buying. In other words, you can buy more stock based on the value of the price appreciation of your previous stock. We'll loan you more money to buy that stock. In other words, in capitalism now, you don't even need money capital to invest in financial assets. As long as the price is rising of the asset, they'll give you more of the asset, right? That's called inside credit. There's money credit provided by central banks, and there's inside credit provided just by the financial system itself, you see. And a lot of that is running amok. Well, so many retail investors jumped into the stock market in 2014-15. I think something like 80% of the Chinese stock appreciation is by private retail investors, that the bubble got out of hand, 120% growth in 1 year in the stock market. Then the Chinese government tried to dampen that, the bubble, just as they did in on the private property bubble. But in doing it, it backfired on them, and it began collapsing. Well, once it began collapsing, the bubble, which began in June 2015, one of the ways to solve it, according to the Chinese policymakers, was to allow margin buying again. Right? So the bubble continues, but the bubble unwinds. At some point, investors say, I'm going to take my money and run. And that's exactly what they're doing. And we have a $1 trillion capital flight coming out of China now, and probably trillions more coming out of emerging markets. And it's all flowing back to the West. Once again, all that money capital created by central banks that flowed into China emerging markets is flowing back now as interest rates purportedly will rise. Long-term interest rates are rising in the U.S., and so the money is flowing back, and now short-term rates, a little bit of an increase here, which is supposedly translated into long-term rates. The problem is long-term rate increases rising. But as long-term U.S. interest rates rise, right, so does the dollar. Right? People want to convert their declining currencies and falling markets into dollars to invest in the U.S., which is relatively better than other economies. Not great, but relatively better. That's all that matters. So the money is being converted, which drives up the conversion, not just the rates, but the conversion of other currencies drives up the dollar and thus drives down those currencies even more. And that's what's happening around the world. We got a currency war, which has been exacerbated by QEs in Europe and Japan, QE monetary policies. Where those countries and sectors attempt to gain market share of world exports that are shrinking at the expense of their competitors and neighbors. So the currency war is well on its way, continuing everywhere, and causing great instability. And to some extent, the currency instability is driving the slowdown in the real global economy and trade as well. There's real reasons in the domestic economies behind that, but the currency instability is also responsible for that. And as the dollar rises, the interest rates rise, with the money flowing back, global oil declines, because there's a direct inverse relationship between the price of oil as a financial asset and the rise in the dollar. And that's exacerbated by other real causes behind the decline. As the global economies and economies in the world slow, there's not that much demand for oil. And of course, lower demand means lower prices. But also at the same time, we have an excess supply being generated by Saudi Arabia trying to break the back financially of its U.S. Oil and gas fracking competitors that have come on the scene in the last couple of years, threatening to take market share from Saudi Arabia. So Saudi Arabia in 2014 decided to go to war to protect its global control of oil prices with the frackers in the U.S., and that set off the initial leg of the global oil glut and decline. So we get demand forces and we have these political forces that are creating excess supply going on. Other oil-producing countries like Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, and others totally depend, or significantly depend, on sale of oil to fund their budgets. So as oil declines in price, they pump more of it to maintain their income levels that they need for their domestic budget. So you see, we got this very complex situation of slowing global economy, fight between Saudi Arabia and the U.S., increases supply, and supply continues even though less demand from these other sources of global oil as they try to just maintain their global budgets. It's like a downward spiral going on. Venezuela, for example, 97% of all its government budget comes from oil sales. It's got to maintain that income level, so it just pumps more at a lower price. You see, and we get this phenomenon of oil supplies and storage being filled up everywhere in the world, tankers all filled up. You know, how far they can go with that remains to be seen. And now we got the price going down even further in the last couple of weeks, because now Iran is coming online and starting, you know, ending the sanctions there, and it's going to add a significant amount of additional oil as well to the global market. You know, a lot of this Saudi attack on Iran is not religious. You know, it's all about oil and revenue and the price of oil. Saudi Arabia desperately attempted to maintain the sanctions on Iran because they knew if the sanctions were lifted in this recent deal with the U.S. and Europe and Iran, that would put even more pressure on their ability to sell oil. Saudi Arabia is so desperate that they're now going to create an IPO, public offering, for a consortium here to get more money into the economy to buy. You know, investors come in and you can get a piece of our action. Right? Interesting that they're actually doing that now. That means it shows great stress on Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is losing control of global oil prices for various reasons I've just described, and they're desperate, growing desperate, and desperate people do desperate things. Anyway, so now we got this other factor of Iran coming online that's causing global oil to decline. And if global oil prices decline, right, then some of these countries, the sovereign debt becomes a big problem, government debt, because they can't finance their government debt. They're not making, these are government companies, you know, in Russia and Venezuela and elsewhere in Nigeria, and they can't pay the debt that ran up, you see. It's the relationship between debt and income, the ability to finance it, that's key. And again, most economists look at them separately. Or left economists say, oh, it's debt magnitude, don't explain the mechanism by which debt is related to financial speculation and asset prices and overinvestment and how that causes a crash in the economy as the financial cycle declines and drags down the real cycle. Just talking about levels of debt says nothing. What's key is, are you able to pay for that debt? As long as your prices are rising and your income is rising, you can raise debt forever, as long as they rise in tandem. But once your income growth slows below, then you're in trouble. And in China's in trouble because its liquidity, and therefore debt, has accelerated far faster than the real economy has grown. And now the real economy is slowing down, and income is also slowing down, while debt does not slow down. Debt does not go away. Your income can, but your debt does not, you see. And what is the debt in China? Well, total debt in China is $7.4 trillion in 2007. Today, $30 trillion. So it's tripled. Debt has tripled. Just as the liquidity has doubled and tripled, you see, direct relationship between liquidity, money growth, and by the central bank and foreign shadow banks, so forth, and the debt growth. And most of this is non-government, non-household debt. It's business debt, financial and non-financial. That is the big problem. And if you look at China, how much of that $30 trillion is a private business debt, About $20 trillion. $20 trillion is private business debt. About $13 trillion, roughly, I would say, of non-financial businesses, and the rest is financial businesses in China. So $20 trillion of the $30 trillion in debt. It's not government debt, not federal government debt, and it's not even household debt, although both have increased. It's private debt, and it's the same thing if you look at the rest of the emerging markets, particularly in places like Latin America. 25 trillion of it is private corporate debt. Borrowing of this huge amount of money that flowed into these markets and expanding, taking on the debt and expanding. And as long as commodity sales and oil sales and semi-manufacturing sales continue to rise, as it did in the early years after 2009, they could afford to pay the principal and interest on that debt. But now that income is declining. The prices are declining, and the volume of sales are declining. Therefore, the amount of revenue they get from exports is declining. But the debt has not gone away. The debt is still there. So that's the stuff that bankruptcies are made out of, you see, when you get the big divergence between your income growth and your debt growth. That's the nature of the problem. And when you take on too much debt, you know, when the business cycles and the slowdowns come as they do, you're left holding the bag, the default bag. And when defaults occur, then your financial assets and your price of your assets declined even faster, you see, and therefore your income declines even faster. China has had three bubbles in recent years as this imbalance between debt and income has occurred. First, the financial asset bubble in property markets, then in wealth management funds, which are kind of the equivalent of junk bond loans in China, WIMPs, right? Kind of the same thing. That's how they finance, keep these old industries going that can't survive anymore and can't get direct loans. Get some of this private wealth created from the bubbles elsewhere flowing into these old line industries and companies in China to finance them. Well, that's just like a junk bond. You know, a junk bond is when a company that's not doing very well sells bonds, at very corporate bonds, at a very high price because, you know, it's not stable and they have to pay more for it. Well, WIMPs are like junk bonds in China, and that is a problem there. Second bubble, and the third bubble, of course, is the stock market bubble. And these big bubbles are beginning to unwind now. And that's part of the problem. How is the likely contagion from China to the U.S. markets? Well, several possible ways. U.S. multinational companies now earn 30% of their revenue from sales in China, so if China is slowing down, U.S. corporate revenue earnings is going to slow down, and we're going to see that reflected in earnings reports here this first semester, right? And it has a big effect. You know, that 30% has about 1% of U.S. GDP numbers. Right? 1% when you're only growing 2% is pretty big. Right? There's a psychological effect as the decline in the equity markets in China are reflected in declines in equity markets in the U.S. and elsewhere, and we're seeing that right now. Stocks are down another 400 from a price today. Capital flight out of China. Currency instability elsewhere, and currency competition elsewhere. All these are ways in which the contagion of this bubble unwinding in China will be reflected in other markets here in the U.S. and elsewhere. And this is going to continue. China is the canary in the coal mine, and it's going to cause a decline elsewhere. Okay, we'll talk about that in the coming weeks.